there's one thing you can say about America, it's a country of large appetites. We gobble up natural resources, sprawl our homes and cities across the landscape, and gas guzzle our way to global warming. So maybe it's no surprise that we're also obsessed with food and eating, and have been from the beginning. I'm Anne Strainchamps, in for Kathleen Dunn today. Our guest this hour is Frederick Kaufman. He's the author of a scintillating new history of America, told through the stomach. Kaufman's subject is the extremes of American eating, our binge and purge mentality toward food, and he traces it all the way back to the day the first hungry Puritans scrambled off the Mayflower, and all the way forward to the technological wonders of the modern waste treatment plant. The book is A Short History of the American Stomach. Its author is Frederick Kaufman. He's an English and journalism professor at the City University of New York, and he's on the phone with us today. Hi, Frederick.
How are you doing?
Good. How are you? Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You know, it's hard not to notice how weirdly obsessive Americans are about eating. You know, we're the country that turned dieting into a science, and we're also some of the fattest people in the world with whole TV channels devoted to cooking and eating. I guess I sort of thought this was all just a function of modern hyper-living, but your book suggests we've really been this way all along.
That's what was really shocking to me. When I looked into the history of this, I thought I would see some sort of growth or change over time, but in fact, no matter how far back I looked into American history, I saw the exact same kinds of obsessions with eating too much and eating too little.
For instance? Wait, how far back does it go? What's the very beginning?
Well, of course, you know, we're starting off when when the Puritans step off the Mayflower. What's interesting about the Puritans on their way over here is how focused on eating and particularly not eating they were. You have to realize that to the Puritans, to the medicine during the Puritan period, the stomach was the center of all bodily medicine. And not only, of course, medicine was a rather more capacious term than it is now, so it also included psychology. So the key to your psychology, the key to your bodily health, and of course the key to your spiritual health, which is, of course, of paramount importance to the Puritans, could be gauged through your relationship to your own stomach.
Wait, how does your relationship with your stomach affect your spiritual life, if you're a Puritan, or were?
Well, of course, the greatest horror of the time was dyspepsia, which has continued throughout American history.
All is that the way like until indigestion?
Indigestion, of course. And indigestion was a sign of clearly a rocky relationship with God. And in fact, there was Cotton Mather, the great Puritan divine, believed that satanic possession was indicated by indigestion and dyspepsia. And in fact, he had proof. Would you like to hear this proof?
Yes, I would. I'm also sort of thinking that there's a whole new avenue that for advertising that Tums and the Tums and the other companies haven't even begun to tap.
Well, you know, I think everybody understands about Americans is that we eat too much meat, and this began very early. And in fact, the early American diets around the time of the Puritans consisted almost entirely of meat. And what did this mean? This meant a great preponderance of intestinal worms.
Ooh.
And in fact, worms were a huge threat, and particularly to the children. Early Puritan children died of intestinal worms. The best way out for an intestinal worm was up through the mouth. And Cotton Mather was witness at many extractions of intestinal worms, who he saw these worms as the embodiment of Satan, these long black worms. In fact, he reported at one point a removal of one worm out of the mouth that measured more than 100 feet long.
Oh my gosh, I thought that was an urban legend.
No, this is true.
My dad told me that when I was like 12 years old as a horror story. Honestly, I thought he made it up. Cotton Mather says that.
And then, of course, you know, this whole notion of the worm in the gut. This is not just some little ghettoized strange moment in American history. In the great short stories of Nathaniel Hawthorne, we hear about the man with a serpent in his gut, and how it gnaws him. It's eating him from the inside. These are the classic obsessions of America. Are obsessions about the stomach.
You know, this is really interesting because if that's in our, you know, really not that far off history, you know, it's still there in the American subconscious somehow. So how do you think that fear of the serpent in the gut still haunts us?
Well, I think all you have to do is take a look at the
at the diet books today. I think you have to look at the newspapers, the great fears the of the toxic eating environment in which we're living, and sodas in schools, and cloned beef, and also the perfectionism of the stomach, the an unbelievable insistence on perfecting your body through diet. I've seen outrageous diets, which not only have to do with what you eat, but your relationship to the higher power, you know, the maker's diet, Mary Moran's Love Yourself Thin, which is really all about dieting through Christ. This is still with us.
I'm thinking about the movie Alien. Wasn't the monster born through the stomach?
Absolutely, and I think that one of the reasons it resonated so well was because people have always had this uneasy relationship with their stomach and a great sense of ambivalence. You call it love or hate. Either way, it seems to be the center.
So the love-hate thing has gone all along through the whole stream of American history. You know, so you've got the Puritans with this very hateful relationship with the pleasures of the flesh and the desires of the stomach. And then you also have some really fascinating quotations from Washington Irving from his days as a journalist. This is early 1800s America. And he makes America sound like a cornucopia that's just overflowing with food in an almost obscene way.
Well, Washington Irving noted all the way back in 1803 what he called the American eating mania, that people were eating all over this country, eating in the streets, eating in the theaters. Everywhere he went, people were just eating as much food as fast as they possibly could eat it.
And this was before McDonald's.
Absolutely. This was before McDonald's. There are street vendors and retailers way before McDonald's. Absolutely. And particularly oysters were one of the great manias.
So really, this is literally true? There was all this eating in the streets in early America?
I should point out, you see, something people don't realize about American markets, even in the early 19th century, is that they completely blew away any of the European markets. The amount and the variety of food for sale in American markets was beyond the imagination of anything that Europe had seen for, you know, 300, 400, 500 years. I mean, the number of fish, you could buy dolphin, you could buy porpoise, you could buy snook. There were 20 or 30 kinds of duck for sale at a typical American market. It was all over. Nobody had ever seen this variety. And plus, of course, when people got to this country and needed to eat, all of a sudden there was a new liberty, a new freedom about what they could eat, because all of a sudden here all the old laws were broken. They saw the Native Americans eating skunk. They saw them eating horsefoot. They saw them eating the bark off of trees. And it was kind of like there is a new dispensation for eating in this country.
Huh. There's a quotation from Washington Irving that I loved. It's just a line, but he called this the sublime spectacle of love of country elevating itself from a sentiment into an appetite.
Only in this country could the appetite the highest and most sublime spiritual sentiment.
But it also suggests there's something peculiarly American about this, that we somehow have made food and the natural bounty of the American harvest and our very identity, we've wrapped all these things up together.
I think one of the things which I discovered, which really was fascinating, was once again the centrality of American stomach science, which really hit an apex right around the period before the American Constitution was written. And so right at the time that the political foundations for this country are coming together in this revolutionary way, the way people understand their bodies is through their stomach, and the stomach is the center of their psychology, and the stomach is the center of their medicine. It's fascinating. And in fact, the first foodies in this country, full-blown foodies, were people like Benjamin Franklin, who was completely obsessed with what he ate.
He was?
Absolutely. He, for instance, credited his mastery of mathematics to the fact that he was on a vegetarian diet during that period. He believed that oatmeal would set liberty loose in American souls.
That's good news for those of us who like oatmeal.
Absolutely. I like oatmeal.
So do I. I've been on an oatmeal kick lately. It's cold here. It's a good winter morning thing. Now I can think of it as democratic, too. What was it about oatmeal that would set democracy loose, did you think?
Well, you know, I it's not so strange, really. I mean, if you just look at any of the vegan websites today or the raw food websites, you'll see absolutely similar arguments to the kind that Benjamin Franklin was using, you know, 200-300 years ago. Benjamin Franklin had his own diet guru. He was a guy named Thomas Tryon, who was a Brit, who wrote a book called The Way to Health, which is perhaps not so surprisingly imitated by Franklin's great work, The Way to Wealth. In The Way to Wealth, the first metaphor Franklin uses for money is solid pudding. And and so, of course, the money culture is inextricably tied with our food culture, and this also originates with Franklin and continues.
You said there were some early diet gurus all the way back then. What kind of diets did they prescribe, and who were these people?
Well, you know, they prescribed precisely the same kind of diets that are being prescribed today. You know, I mean, look at the great Michael Pollan, who is, you know, one of our great diet gurus of today, who prescribes, eat simple food, eat vegetables. This has been American dietary dogma for hundreds of years. I mean, let's look back to, for instance, William Alcott, who was the most famous graduate of Yale's medical school of 1827. And he was a firm believer in simple foods. Not only that, nothing should ever be mashed if it were going to be eaten. No more than two ingredients per dish. He went so far as to be an advocate of single substance eating. And in fact, if he was not just some weird wacko, there were people in America in the Jacksonian period who would brag, I spent an entire year eating nothing but apples, or I spent a year eating nothing but crackers. And you can even think of their perfectionist communities, such as Fruitlands, where people came together to eat perfectly and thus form a utopia. And of course, they would disparage the potato for, you know, growing downwards.
You know, you listen to this history and you just think, we're just repeating the same history over and over and over again. And you talk about the people living on apples, and I think, oh, we have that. It's called the raw food movement.
Absolutely. Hmm. Absolutely. And in fact, when I was doing this book, I spent a lot of time with raw foodies. And of course, I infiltrated one of the raw milk covens. You know, there's a whole movement to drink unpasteurized milk. It's an old movement, but it's come back. And, of course, it's illegal in most of the United States to drink unpasteurized milk and to eat unpasteurized cheese. And I infiltrated one of these movements. And, of course, what those people are most concerned about are the vegans, who are soy milk drinkers.
Oh, we'll come back to this in just a second. We're talking with Frederick Kaufman. He's an English and journalism professor at City University of New York. And he is with us today talking about his new book, A Short History of the American Stomach. He's also got a current article in Harper's Magazine. We'll be talking about that, too. It's called Wasteland, and it is a journey through the American cloaca. So we'll do food from start to finish in this hour. I'm Anne Strangchamps in for Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we're here talking about the short history of the American stomach in this hour. Do you have stomach-related anecdotes, thoughts about food and eating and our American obsessions with both eating and dieting? You can join us by calling toll-free 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you're in the Madison area, you can dial 263-1890, or as always, email it's talk@wpr.org. We'll welcome your questions and comments this hour. Frederick, you also talk about some early food gurus in America, America's earliest foodies, I guess. There's a woman named Miss Leslie.
Yes, Miss Eliza Leslie was the greatest cookbook writer of the 19th century. She was a great Boston wit who actually ended up her life. She had grown so large that she couldn't even walk anymore by the end of her life. But her Directions for Cookery was the best-selling cookbook of the 19th century, sold hundreds of thousands of copies, and you would not believe the recipes in this cookbook. I mean, if you think that haute bourgeois foodies are a creation of the post-World War II Julia Child watching Americans, you are sadly mistaken. You see unbelievable recipes for raspberry charlotte and for coconut fool and endless unbelievable recipes.
Have you ever cooked anything from it?
Absolutely not. You got to realize that we're talking 19th century cookbooks. It's rather difficult to follow those directions. The first American cookbook was Amelia Simmons' Directions for Cookery, which was published in 1796. And just to give you an example of the kind of recipes we're talking about, her recipe for federal pancake included 27 quarts of ultra-refined sugar.
Oh, my gosh. 27 quarts?
Huge amounts.
How many people was she going to feed? A city?
Epic eating goes back a long way in this country.
Really?
Absolutely. I mean, let's talk about Paul Bunyan, mythological eaters. He, of course, ate nothing but moose meat. I guess he was a follower of William Alcott and the single substance ingesting. But his band of axemen, supposedly he had to have a group of 7 cement mixers made up every morning just to make their pancake batter.
Now, this is really ignorant of me. I thought Paul Bunyan was just a... Was Paul Bunyan real?
No, okay. Paul Bunyan is...
Joe across the glass is shaking his head at me like, no, you dummy. Of course no. He wasn't real.
But, you know, Davy Crockett, of course, was real. And Davy Crockett lore, you know, he used to say, I'll eat any man opposed to Jackson. he would eat nothing but bear, Davy Crockett.
Really?
Yeah, sure. And of course, I actually came to know Dale Boone, who's the great 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 grandson of the great Daniel Boone, of course. And Dale Boone is a professional competitive eater. I mean, only in this country is competitive eating a professional sport. Actually, that's not true. In Japan, too, it's a professional sport. And this great descendant of Daniel Boone, he holds world records in reindeer sausage and pork and beans.
Oh my gosh!
Incredible.
Have you been to any of those competitive eating contests? What are they like?
Sadly, I have been to numerous competitive eating contests. I was at the first ever Thanksgiving Day competitive eating contest, in which they competed with turkey and all the fixings, and of course, many hot dog eating contests. Yes.
There's somebody, isn't there a woman called the Spider Woman? She's this tiny little Japanese woman who just kills all the American heavy eaters in the contest.
The Americans are coming back. You know, she's a great eater. What's his name? Joey Chestnut is the champion American eater right now, and he actually broke the world record of Mr. Kobayashi in hot dogs just this past July 4th.
What are these records like? Like, what is the world record?
Well, eating contests generally last 12 minutes, and the hot dog eating contest, Joey Chestnut, I believe the number was 63 Nathan's Famous hot dogs in 12 minutes.
Oh, my gosh. That just boggles the mind.
It really, if you actually see it happening, it's even more amazing.
Do these people keep them down?
Well, regurgitation is a violation of the International Federation of Competitive Eating rules.
So you're disqualified?
Although Dale Boone has been known to suffer from what's called meat sweats, which has made his, you know, for a somewhat tenuous position in some of these events.
Meat sweats?
Meat sweats.
Which is what?
I'm not sure, but it certainly has hindered his attempts on many an occasion to ingest as much as he possibly could in his little time. The first competitive eating contest in America dates back once again to the Federalist period down here in New York at the South Street Seaport, where a young man was elevated on a stage and proceeded in front of a large audience in a 15-minute time period to down 50 eggs, shell and all. Hard-boiled eggs.
Wow. That's dramatic.
Yeah, people have been obsessed by this in this country for a long time. They're out on the frontier, they used to have competitive eating contests with long, long strips of cow intestine. And in this kind of homoerotic act, two very rough-and-ready frontiersmen would put the intestine in their mouth and then race for who could, you know, get to the middle soonest.
Somehow that's calling up images of Cotton Mather's serpent for me.
Well, clearly.
What do you think is the underlying psychology behind this American kind of competitive eating, gorge yourself thing?
I really call it manifest dinner. I think that there's a political end to this. I think that there's a sense of we must consume this continent. We must have it all within ourselves. It's kind of a very low misreading of Walt Whitman's "I must, you know, contain multitudes." I think this
we're taking it literally,
quite literally, absolutely. And I think that this continent, you know, in terms of its geography, there is a great sense of we are going to consume it. We are going to move forward, and as we move west, we are going to be eating and making it all ours. I think there is also a sense that the eating was a way to conquer America's sense that we didn't belong here, that we all came from somewhere else, that there were people here when we already got here, and so to make it ours, to make it truly ours, we must consume it. And I think that's also why in all these diet books there's a very strong sense of this is the primal eldest diet, this is the caveman diet, this is the maker's diet, this is the way people are supposed to eat in the most primitive way. I think that American obsession with the primitive has to do with the fact that we're belated on this continent.
That's really interesting. And then, you know, no wonder we created gas-guzzling cars. No wonder we're consuming a huge amount of the world's fossil fuels and natural resources. That's somehow just part of our identity. That's who and what we are.
And this was Franklin's great insight into the stomach, which is that the stomach, the American stomach, isn't just within our bodies. It's our whole way of looking at the world. It's our way of looking at consumption. It's partially why how he described his Franklin stove, which was he saw it as some sort of exterior stomach, which would help in terms of our energy consumption. I think you're absolutely right there, Anne.
Does this thinking about the American identity in this way, as sort of in terms of appetite and thinking of Americans as like this very large stomach, does that present to you any sort of thoughts about how to achieve a more rational or more peaceful sort of American identity?
Oh, that's so hopeful.
It's very Midwestern of me, isn't it?
I tend to be more of an ironist and a pessimist. I don't necessarily see. I actually do not see the a happy ending necessarily. In fact, what I see is on the other side is a globalization of the American stomach, and the American stomach mania and the American way of consumption is now being exported around the world. So, in fact, instead of seeing less of it, I think we're going to see more and more.
Hmm. Oh, we've got a few people on the line I want to get to. Daniel in Rice Lake called in. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. Was obesity considered virtuous, especially compared to being thin aesthetically and as a measure of health in colonial times? And when did it change that being thin became virtuous?
Okay.
It's a great question, Daniel. I don't think there ever was this change. I think from the beginning, in different aspects of American culture, thin was beautiful and fat was beautiful. A lot of people see this as a bifurcation between the Puritans of the North and the Dutch a little bit farther south. The Dutch, according to Washington Irving, of course, were a colony of great eaters. And the fatter the burgermeister, the more liable he was to be in a position of authority. Whereas, of course, the Puritan Yankee was typically rail thin. And so what we see is this kind of this dialectic from the very beginning, which has stayed with us.
And what about in terms of women's bodies? Because there was a period of time when women were you're supposed to be large and buxom. Think of the Victorian ideals.
Absolutely, and I was speaking actually of both sexes at that point, which is the Dutch women were much larger and more buxom, and that was considered the sign of beauty.
And what about when did our current obsession with rail thin, stick thin women begin? Do you think?
Well, I think that that's very difficult. That is very difficult to pinpoint, Anne. It's very, first of all, the beauty culture that has kind of now full blown in the latter half of the 20th century in America. That beauty culture, I would say, emerges from the physical culture of eating culture, in the sense that you don't really see the same kind of beauty culture and focus on the ultra thin in the 19th century or the 18th century. I think that culture comes from other other technologies such as photography, which have really enabled the reproduction of so many of those ultra-thin images.
Mm. What kind of research did you do for the book, kind of moving into the present?
Well, I wanted to understand the future of food and the future of American consumption. And I think it's very interesting how it dovetails with the news today in terms of genetically modified meat. I spent a lot of time with man-made oysters that people are trying to use to save the Chesapeake Bay, which are unlike any oyster that God ever made. These are oysters which are completely genetically modified. And so I spent a lot of time with the oyster guys. And just last week, I was out in Oregon talking to some fruit prospectors who are trying to figure out new fruit, the next wave fruit for the 21st century.
Well, wait, what's coming? What's the next wave of fruit?
Well, what was interesting is 2 weeks before that, I was out in the Midwest. I was talking to a woman there who's doing all this research in fruit shape, which I think is probably, even before we get to the new fruit, we're going to be seeing a lot of work in terms of new fruit shape. So,
what do you mean fruit shape?
Well, this woman who's out in the Midwest has isolated two genes that work in tomato. One gives it that kind of pear shape, and that's called ovate. And another gene, she is called sun, and that gives it a very elongated shape. And so there are a lot of people, of course, in industry who would be interested in a square tomato. Certainly the people.
Because they pack better?
Of course, they pack better. And so if you're going to be selling tomato paste, why are you going to waste that extra space in your box with a round tomato when you could have a square one? And, of course, McDonald's would, I'm sure, be very interested in a very long, thin, salami-like tomato that you could chop, you know, endlessly for your burger with much less waste.
This is really disturbing. So so food scientists are really going to genetically modify food to suit the packaging and fast food industry?
Well, you know, I have to say that, you know, you say it's disturbing and scientists are going to do this. I've got news. This is already over. This has been done. Almost every food and almost every fruit that you're buying in a supermarket today is somebody else's intellectual property. Everything that we're looking at has already been patented. And if you say, okay, I'm just going to go for that organic loaf of bread, and I'm going to look at that ingredient label, and what's on it? Well, there's flour on it, there's salt on it, and there's water. I'm going to buy it. Now, let's be serious. Let's think for a second. How is that possible to have a retail loaf of bread, organic or not, that only has three ingredients? I know how it's possible. I actually traveled to Denmark to see it done. It's done with genetically modified enzymes. You don't want artificial ingredients. You have to use some sort of process to get the proper mouthfeel, to get the proper stability of the molecules, if you're going to have a retail product. And the genetically modified enzyme is the way it's done. And, of course, it doesn't have to be on the ingredient label because the enzymes that are used in the modification and the creation of the food are extracted and taken out before the food hits the shelves. So the game is already over.
Hmm. So what's next? What's still to come then? You were talking about the new fruits.
Oh, new fruits. Well, you know, the funny thing is that as we can see with the whole American food mania once again rearing its head about genetically modified, or I should say cloned meat, I think a lot of the retailers are a little bit, you know, they think twice before they spend all that money to bring in new fruit, because I think they feel that that frankenfruit is going to not go over well with the American public. And so I think that instead of that, they're going to probably take a more conservative approach, and they are going to try to make the fruit and the vegetables that we're eating now slightly modified with DNA so as to make them to serve all kinds of purposes. And I should make a point about genetically modified fruits and vegetables, for instance, which is that I do not quite understand why they have such a bad rap. Because, in fact, if you were to place a genetically modified tomato next to an ungenetically modified tomato, and you were to then next to it say, this is the number of tonnage of pesticides used to create this tomato, and here's on this end how much was used on that one. Here's how much diesel fuel was used for this one. Here's how much diesel fuel was used for that one. You'll see that the genetic modifications are much more environmentally friendly. It's always ironic to me when I think about the people who are very anti-global warming, for instance, as I am, and one of their great arguments is, look at the scientific evidence, President Bush. Let's take a look at the scientific evidence. But when we're talking about our food, why no? They will not look at the scientific evidence. They will not see that one is much more ecologically friendly than the other.
We're talking with Frederick Kaufman. He's the author of A Short History of the American Stomach. He's an English and journalism professor at the City University of New York. He's also the author of a current article in Harper's Magazine, which we'll get to in a minute. It's called Wasteland, A Journey Through the American Cloaca. And you can join our conversation by calling 800-642-1234. I'm Ann Strandchamps, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about American food, the history of American food, and American attitudes towards eating and dieting in this hour. Our toll-free number is 800-642-1234. We welcome your questions and comments. If you're in the Madison area, you can call 263-1890, 263-1890. And we're talking again with Fred Kaufman, author of A Short History of the American Stomach. And, you know, Fred, now that we've spent all this time on the American stomach, I kind of wanted to spare a few minutes for the American gut.
Oh, no.
You wrote this fascinating piece for the current issue of Harper's, in which you explored in really awesome detail the American sewage system. Did you kind of figure it was your job to trace the path our food takes all the way to the end?
Well, my editor and I have a great editor at Harper's. His name is Luke Mitchell. And after we had accomplished, you know, a number of these strange, bizarre food stories we were doing, we were sitting around having drinks, and it was, what's next? And I think it both occurred to us at the same time, there is only one answer to that question.
Yeah, what happens after you flush?
Precisely.
That's a question every 10-year-old asks. And, you know, I should say, I mean, I really want to talk about this. I sort of worried a little bit that people would think this was incredibly distasteful and they'd be offended. So, you know, I hope if you're listening, you've got kind of a strong stomach and you're not faint of heart, because I actually think this is a really interesting subject. But then with a 10-year-old at home, I have a very high tolerance for scatological humor and so on. So your piece opens with this kind of horrific visit that you pay to a family in New York State, and they're living through what is, from what you say, becoming a not uncommon problem, sewage backup?
Well, every day the American flush is 5 billion gallons. That's the collective American flush. And increasingly we're finding it more and more difficult to find a place to park it.
Yeah.
well, in fact, this what we're talking about is the suburb of New York City called Yorktown Heights, and a man who pleaded with me not to use his real name in the article, and I respect his wishes, whose waste can no longer flow into the Yorktown Heights sewage system because the Yorktown Heights sewage system is already in violation of EPA standards, and so he has to try to figure out a way to get rid of his own waste products in a septic tank in his backyard, and he cannot. And so the waste is constantly bubbling up. And as Ann, you point out, this is not uncommon. It's happening all over the United States. I mean, you know, in Los Angeles, the surfer websites post hourly runoff warnings. In Waikiki, Hawaii, just a couple of years ago, there was a 48 million gallon upsurge, and in fact, a tourist who was peering into the morass fell in and died. North Carolina has huge problems. The state of Oregon has huge problems. State of Ohio has huge problems. It's a huge infrastructure issue.
I guess, you know, it really is the kind of subject most of us don't think about, don't want to think about.
You wake up in the morning, you brush your teeth, you flush the toilet, you think it goes to the center of the earth, but somebody's got to deal with it.
Yeah, too bad we can't just send it to the center of the earth. We sent it to a much more interesting place. You wound up touring one of these huge, huge waste treatment plants in New York City. What was this like?
Well, I was very scared. You know, I had my own trepidation before I was given permission to visit what's called the North River Solid Waste Treatment Plant, which is this 27 acres of concrete right on the western shore of Harlem that's on top of this gigantic concrete cesspit are three swimming pools, an ice skating rink, and a carousel. And inside is the most amazing science I've ever seen. It's really miraculous how every single day you're looking at this plant is one of 14 solid waste treatment plants in New York City. Every day this plant is processing something like 135 million gallons of wastewater and ultimately having almost a null effect on the environment.
That is astonishing. You said you were kind of scared. I can imagine if it feels like, I would bet, you know, going into the belly of the beast. Did the place smell?
Well, it's very interesting. The place, of course, does smell, but because of community relations, it cannot smell outside. So, for instance, the plant was built in the 1970s. It cost New York City $1 billion. $100 million of it went straight into odor control. So in this huge plant, you know, there are rooms in this plant that were so large, I literally could not see to the other end, hundreds of yards long. In this plant, there are 12 complete air changes per hour. Every hour, there's 600,000 cubic feet of air are pumped in and 750,000 cubic feet of air are pumped out, and it's all scrubbed. There are bleach scrubbers and carbon filters so that you wouldn't know it's there.
Hmm. Is this the plant that you said one of the guys told you when it's really cold there, it snows inside the plant?
Yes, it's so huge that it has its own environmental...
microclimate.
It has its own weather. So, for instance, sometimes there'll be a clear day outside the plant, but it'll be raining inside the plant, which is rather frightening.
Depends on what's in the rain.
We know what's in that rain.
So you tracked this raw sewage, you know, from it arrives at the plant in its, you know, absolutely unmentionable state, and it goes through several, you know, levels of cleaning and siphoning off and so on, and it winds up getting trucked or shipped to another plant, right? And the end product, you get these little pellets.
You know, ever since the Ocean Dumping Ban Act of 1988, we have had to figure out what to do with our waste as in terms of a land-based economy. We can't just throw it in the ocean anymore. And because of this, entire industries have sprung up about human waste and what to do with it and how to market it. And you're absolutely right. It goes from one plant to the next. It gets dewatered. It gets dried. It gets composted. It turns into little pellets. And then it gets marketed. And, in fact, you might have given it away, but if you want to get it back, you're going to have to buy it. You're going to have to go to your local Target or Agway or Home Depot or Walmart, and you're going to have to pay some hard-earned ducats for that potting soil, which is, you know, the easiest way to get it back. But, in fact, human waste is used and sold in cemeteries, in highway fills to fill strip mines, and it's all golf courses, those beautiful greens of the golf courses. You got it. That's where it comes from. I found a company called Synagro Technologies that is the only company in America that's devoted exclusively to what's called the residuals management industry. And in 2005, they made...
That's a really nice euphemism.
Yeah, the euphemisms in this business abound. They made, in 2005, they made $338 million selling this substance. And in
my
fact,
God, so $3,038,000 they made basically...
$338 million.
Basically selling our,
yes,
you know what, back to us.
Absolutely, that's right.
That's sort of extraordinary. Hey,
it's
a fascinating story, actually. We've got Mike on the line from Oshkosh. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. I have a few interesting little facts for you that you might be interested in. There's currently a project being developed. I think they're in full operation by now in California, where they're taking roughly 70 million gallons a day of wastewater and treating this and turning it directly back into drinking water without first discharging it into a river. Now, here in Oshkosh, we do something very similar. There are little plants upstream from us in Winneconne and Omro that treat the sewage, and then they dump it into the Fox and the Wolf Rivers, and here we in Oshkosh ultimately draw water from these river systems back in and turn it into drinking water.
It is sort of astonishing to think that you can take human waste and basically do enough to it that it becomes clean enough to drink. What exactly do we does one do to it to get it to that state?
Well, you have to do a lot more than we do here. Out in California, they're treating it with ultraviolet light and ultrafine filtration. But the water that we discharge into the Fox River is cleaner than the Fox River itself. And we've pointed this out on many occasions, and people say, well, then why don't we pipe it directly over to the water filtration people so they don't have to clean it up as much? And a lot of it is just aesthetics.
Yeah. Yeah, and community reaction, I guess.
Yes. Very interesting about California. I had heard that, in fact, they were pumping the water not directly into the system, but into the groundwater that was near it so that it would have further filtration. But the fact of the matter is that a lot of people perceive our waste and this use of waste is a grave threat to nature and humanity. And there are protests, and there are Sludge Watch email listservs and a National Sludge Alliance. And people are getting a little hysterical about it.
Mm. What are the what's the final product like? I mean, you wound up meeting with Sinagro people, and we talked about the little pellets. I mean, what are these things like?
They're just like little pellets of kibble. They don't smell particularly like anything. They're rich in nitrogen. I mean, that's not really the final product. The final product is our morning orange juice. And also, they're thinking about doing all sorts of things with human waste. I met a fellow who was explaining how the Lehigh Cement Company, their plant in Maryland, they actually burn the solid waste, which burns at about the same rate as slag coal, approximately 5,000 British thermal units per cubic pound, and they use it to run their cement plant. And then when the ashes, when they're done with the burning it, they take the ashes and they throw it into the cement mix. So what you have here are the foundations for tomorrow's skyscrapers.
Wow. Are coming out of American toilets today?
Well, I think that a lot of people are excited about the glorious future of waste. I mean, at this point, scientists can scour this stuff on the atomic level, and they've been able to recover Prozac from it and DEET and Chanel No. 5.
Wait. Explain.
They can get the caffeine back.
You can? Wait, how does this work?
Well, this was one of the most shocking things I discovered, which is that, you know, waste science is advancing at this amazing pace. And the scientists, and, you know, North River is full of these white-suited, you know, waste doctors who, you know, have microscopes and all sorts of apparatus, and they can get almost anything that went into it out of it. For instance, your perfume is going to, you know, go down. When you take a shower, it goes down the sewer with everything else. But that perfume that you put on that morning is staying ultimately intact. They can get the Chanel No. 5 out of the waste.
To the point that they could give you a bottle of it?
No, it is not economically feasible at this point. They can get, you know, but they can get the medicines back. It's not economically feasible.
But I mean, what for? What would be the point of reclaiming? I mean, just ultimately recycling everything. You know, you take your Prozac in the morning, and then it, you know, eventually winds up in the toilet and just gets recycled, and somebody else takes it, you know, a month later.
Well, that's the glorious future, but I think that that's not happening quite yet. I think the reason they're doing it is because there's because of the paranoia. It's because of what Mike was telling us, in the sense that, you know, in 1992, the EPA came up with 126 what they call priority pollutants in solid waste, and, you know, arsenic and mercury and chromium lead the way. The problem is that in terms of our waste, it's not just me and my next door neighbor who are going into the sewer, but it's, you know, very large companies like 3M and Monsanto are hooked up to the sewers. Your local hospital is hooked up to the sewer, and all of these things have far-ranging effluvial consequences. And so, because this stuff is going to be used for all sorts of things, including the highest and most refined human waste, which meets EPA requirements to be EQ or exceptional quality, this waste can be used as, you know, to directly fertilize melons and potatoes and other human foodstuffs. Because of this, they need to constantly monitor what is in it. And so they have these very sensitive instruments, and they can then say, okay, this is some caffeine, here's some perfume, here's a trace bit of mercury.
Wow. And so you were speaking literally when you said one of the final end products is our morning orange juice?
Well, absolutely. I think that, for instance, in New York City, the New York Organic Fertilizer Company takes a lot of New York City's daily waste. And the New York Organic Fertilizer Company is a wholly owned subsidiary of Synagro Technologies. It's interesting that, of course, when you see the word organic, well, human waste is 100% organic. So the New York Organic Fertilizer fills up railroad cars every day of these pellets that they make, and they send it straight down to Florida, and it goes to the orange juice.
Wow. Well, it does really seem like sort of the ultimate recycling story, but I'm sure there are listeners who will call in and tell me I'm mistaken. Anyway, so that's probably enough for our waste segment, but we could move on back and talk about food. There were a couple of calls I didn't get to. Sorry to have left you waiting. And hey, we've got Ed on the line from Madison. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, you still there?
Yes, this is Ed from Madison.
Yeah. Did you have a question
or
comment?
In talking about reshaping fruits and vegetables, I read quite a few years ago about the history of Hawaii and the pineapple. And the pineapple, of course, is not native to Hawaii. It was originally or first found somewhere in South America. And it grew to all sorts of shapes and sizes. And eventually, in Hawaii, the Dole Company, whoever, finally got a pineapple that would fit the cans. And that's the way the pineapple now grows in Hawaii.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. This is part of a whole hybridization program that any kind of commercial fruit or vegetable goes through. We don't really think about that. But what you do is the botanists spend many years working to get this perfect cultivar by the traditional hybridization means. Now, all that the new science is doing is taking a shortcut. It's saying, okay, instead of doing traditional hybridization, let's use some shape DNA to get the shape that we're after. The problem with the traditional method of hybridization that Dole Pineapple used in Hawaii is that you get a cultivar, but the gene pool for that cultivar shrinks and stays the same, and thus the pineapples are, it's possible that they're susceptible to viruses and diseases. This is the problem with the banana, the Cavendish dessert banana that we all eat, where the gene pool has shrunk to the extent that a lot of people are concerned of a great banana catastrophe looming in the not-too-distant future. One single virus could kill all those Cavendish bananas.
Thanks. And we've also got Matthew on the line. Hi, thanks for calling.
Thank you. Good morning. As you were just discussing, the waste flow, you can retrieve a lot of chemicals that people have ingested that actually go through us completely, in some cases, unaffected or partially unaffected. And the trouble with genetic engineering is that they've done some studies in Britain where people who have eaten foods that were, for example, corn that had a bacteria sequence and put in it that allows it to be kill off caterpillars so that you don't have to spray the foods and you don't have to use as much of these other chemicals on it. They found that they always thought that those would be broken down completely in the stomach into its constituent matters, and it wouldn't matter what the source was, but they found that some of it unbroken down continues into the small intestines and can be absorbed by the body, and they're not sure what effects that would have on people. And that's why there is the scientific concern about genetically engineered food, is that we don't break things down as well as we thought we would, so we would be ingesting things that are foreign to our body.
Mm-hmm. Frederick?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I think that the general feeling among the scientists is that these bacteria are omnipresent in the quote-unquote natural world, that we're not breaking them down anyway, that yes, it's true that we don't know precisely what it will do, but then again, there are many other unknowns. We don't know what so many other things will do, and I think their ultimate sense is what you're looking at here is DNA, and DNA at that level is not going to be destructive. That's the sense I get from them. You know, I'm not so sure I agree or disagree, but that's what they're telling me.
Frederick, did you come to any larger conclusions after working on all these subjects about the centrality of the stomach and the gut in our life?
I think that in America we've been eating for a long time and obsessed with our gut for a long time, and it's just going to keep going on until we digest the world.
Thanks so much. Frederick Kaufman is a professor of English and journalism at the City University of New York. He's the author of A Short History of the American Stomach. It's a really fun read and just out on shelves right now. You can also check out his piece on waste. It's called Wasteland, A Journey Through the American Cloaca. It's in this month's issue of Harper's Magazine. And Frederick, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. I'm Ann Strainchamps. I've been sitting in for Kathleen Dunn. Thanks to Carmen Jackson, who produced this program, and thank you to Karen Prager, who answered your phone calls, and to Joe, who ran the board and made sure I stayed on time and on top of everything. If you'd like a CD copy of this program, call the radio store. The number is 800-747-7444, and you are listening, as always, to the Idea Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.